Testing one, testing two, testing three, testing four, testing five. Sifu, give me yours.
That was really good, by the way. Way to hit that note. I want to just commend you for not needing a stepladder to hit that note.
I appreciate that. I used to sing for a living. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not.
Wow. You didn't know that? Oh, yeah.
I think maybe you said you were from a musical family.
I taught music, but singing was part of it.
But not for a living.
Yeah, well, for my rice and beans, so to speak. I used to, now the organization, the directors and the CEOs and everything, most of them are now in an organization called, I'll just give a quick shout out, called Heart Global. But it used to be the Young Americans, and that organization still exists. They just took a little bit of an evolution from when I was in there. But we used to travel around all over the world, and I didn't do the world. I had the opportunity. I didn't. Long story short, I did the U.S., all over the U.S. I traveled to like 40 different states almost, and got to live with families in all these different states and teach their kids music. It was just with the that's how I met my wife.
That's awesome.
Yeah, pretty cool. We you know, that's how I knew anything about California. And so that's where we started out of. And this is an interesting SMAFcast episode 31. but anyway, for anybody who's sort of curious, I used to be a music teacher. And my background in martial arts was huge for me because dance was also part of that. And I was my ballet teacher's like favorite male student because the males who came from a ballet background had an ego about it. The males who didn't had anxiety about it. And I personally chalk it up to the martial arts background. Could have been my music, like my instrumental music background as well. But just like, I didn't have any sort of like bashful, like, nerves about me. Like, you know, from talking to me, like if there's something to be learned, I'm interested in learning it. I'm not going to muddy the waters with anxiety or ego. I just want to learn it. And then ego might come later. Anxiety might come later when I have to put it to the test, but hey man, if there's something to learn, like I'm there to learn it. And so I had to learn freaking ballet, and you know, if you look at my build and if you look at me, like I'm not a ballerino, but I had to be. And I ended up being the star ballerina for a summer at a dinner theater, freaking doing a Scottish sword dance. And nice. I had the worst shin splints ever. And I'm pretty sure the arthritis in my big toe is largely due to that experience in my life. But man, was it manly. And super cool every night to dance in a kilt around swords. And then again, you know, you find these moments in life, to take it back to saber martial arts, where the things you like collide with other things you like. And there had been a couple years there where music had overtaken my martial arts training. And I was still able to just enjoy it from the sidelines or do a little bit here and there, learn a little bit about, because I lived near some Native American reservations and stuff. So like I learned a little bit about the tomahawk and the knife and stuff like that from people who knew what they were talking about and knew how to make these things. And, you know, so the sword dance was just another one of those little things where the one thing I liked collided with another thing I liked. And then people started to realize like, oh, he likes Star Wars, but it goes deeper than that. You know, like this guy's super, super lost in his nerdy self and you know, but well, artistry, right? Like
it seems to have worked out for you.
I got a beautiful wife, three beautiful kids, and I owe it largely to those four notes you heard at the beginning of the show to take it right back around full circle. Alan, how have you been? Yes. I haven't talked to you in about a week.
I've been doing okay. I'm doing good. Today I helped one of my teachers and peers go through a bunch of internal martial arts, most of which are still swimming around in my head. we're working on some restructuring of some of our Bagua forms and making sure that there is a intermediate step between what we call beginner's Bagua or baby Bagua and the next level, which is turning, spinning, and insane Bagua.
Yeah, we talked about this 2, 3, 4 episodes ago, and I highly recommend you go back and talk about, or people go back and listen to that episode. I don't remember exactly which one it was, but go back and listen to a bunch of them. Screw it. Yeah, do it.
This time, what we did, so these are high-level martial artists, doing this stuff, and they're grandmaster status, and we still sit down and we watch the video. We watch how we do, our teacher's teacher did it, and then our teacher does it, and go, okay, well, how are we going to do it now?
Yeah,
and it's an evolution of form, and it just struck me that nobody else really does that.
Yeah,
nobody else really that we knew. We would even entrust in something of that nature because it's just too much information, and it's too much. It's like people get lost in their traditionalism, and
that's interesting.
On the other side of it, people forget the tradition, right? And they just go with whatever seems to work best in the cage.
So this is a huge conversation to be had. I don't know if we have the time to have the whole conversation, but we do have some time to tickle it. It's a conversation that I kind of had with my boss tonight, and that I've kind of been having with my other, I call him my boss, but he's the other higher black belt that, so he's older than me. He's been in martial arts about the same amount of time as I have, and yeah, we talk about this all the time. Like, there's that balance of being able to actually quote unquote fight versus like the tradition of martial arts and the deeper meaning behind, like, why would you punish yourself, right? Like going in and sparring or doing this hard training or even just learning forms that are intellectually difficult. Like, why would you torture yourself if not for the traditional values that you're going to be, fortifying within yourself, so to speak. I don't know why more people don't, and I'm probably guilty of that too. Like, yeah, excuse me. I love watching social media is a freaking graveyard of all kinds of good, bad, and ugly. But like, I love looking at like traditional martial arts, hashtag Kenpo, or, something that I'm familiar with, or hashtag Goju Ryu, something I'm mildly familiar with, or hashtag Budokan, who knows? Just type a word that you think is a martial arts word and see what happens. And you get videos and images and all kinds of, like I said, good, bad, and ugly, but I really do find a lot of value in those more traditional ones, because I feel like that's the values I was raised in, while the martial arts that I learned growing up were still very open-ended and almost MMA. I mean, I started martial arts the year before UFC 1, so that would be 1992, right? Okay, so I'm just thinking back, like, there was no such thing as mixed martial arts. There was not really any such thing as Brazilian jiu-jitsu as far as most of the world knew. Even, like, judo was in the Olympics, but like not super, like people knew the judo chop, right? But like that's not even a thing. Like the judo chop's not even a thing. It's right. A karate chop, right? Like the judo chop is not a thing. It's a judo throw. And just like the things that, you know, the Sunday afternoon kung fu movies that I talk about all the time. And it's just those traditional values, though, that's what I grew up with. But at the same time, I was exposed to and taught to enjoy everybody's art. Like, I remember at one tournament, I started to say some maybe inconsiderate, we'll say, things about a different martial art that was there. And my boss was like, listen, man, I understand what you're saying, but don't hold the art responsible for the artist. Like, right. That person was doing their version of whatever they thought that was. That was not what you valued that art to be. That's fine, man. You guys can disagree. Like, if you were their judge, right. You would have given them a bad score. That's the end of it. Right. Move on with your life. And then, obviously, like, being the type of person who enjoys learning, I would go back and I'd do a little Google search on that martial art and go, okay, maybe there's something I can learn from this. But yeah, man, you got me thinking. This is like a really deep topic. Yeah. And I hope people who do currently train in martial arts, kind of think about that. Like if you train, let's just use jiu-jitsu again, because it's a very popular quote unquote traditional martial art. The tradition is not very old. But let's not hold that against them. Let's just say because their tradition is not very old, they're going through some of the growing pains, and part of that is popularity. Growth in popularity, I would call that a growing pain, right? The actual popularity itself is a growing pain because they've gone through a couple waves of it now in the last 30 years or so. And at the same time, the traditional values of every other martial art are still there and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, although the sport aspect and the MMA aspect and the tough guy aspect, every fight goes to the ground, which by the way, about 50 to 70% of fights go to the ground. And usually it's somebody gets knocked out and hits the ground, but whatever. That whole aspect of it has overtaken sort of the traditional values, but they're still there. Like if you watch some of these people who've been training in jiu-jitsu for 30 plus years, they're every bit a martial artist as your karate master who's been training since 1901, right? They're every bit the traditional martial artist. Even if you've only been doing jiu-jitsu for 5 months, but you're super proud of your white belt and you're ready maybe for like a stripe or something, and you want to like just prove to yourself that you can get that stripe, like that's a traditional value. That's traditional martial arts right there. People forget they still wear gis and belts in jiu-jitsu just because they're wearing rash guards and shorts most of the time. Well, it's easier to grapple that way, right? Like, and kung fu, you don't have to do it in silk pajamas. You can do kung fu in jeans and a t-shirt. I mean, like you defined the actual term kung fu a few episodes ago. You could do kung fu in a beekeeper suit, right? You could do kung fu in a judge's robe. But kung fu, the martial arts, you know, it doesn't have to be silk pajamas to be traditional kung fu. You could be in a cage, tap gloves with somebody, be getting paid to fight them and still be doing traditional kung fu in that cage.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a big deep conversation to be had here. I don't know. Give me a closing thought on this topic, and then we'll get into the meat of this episode.
Sure. Well, the biggest thing we figured out was that it didn't matter exactly what we did, because our teachers, our masters and grandmasters, did everything different depending on who they were teaching, and we figured it out. And we also looked at several of the students, like one grandmaster and then another master who was their student, and saw how they did things differently. And we went, Okay. Well, that's an evolution, but why was that evolution necessary? Where did it come from?
Oh,
but at the same time, which is what is there? Is the tradition still there? Is the intention of the actual movement still there? Okay, what is the flow of that? Because there are so many ways to do a reverse punch, an arrow fist, a straight punch. There's so many
different cross, words whatever you want to call it,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. So whatever it is, but you know, there are different ways to punch. And so in what we were doing is called Lihu Bafa, which is basic. Lihu Bafa is the six pillars and eight foundations, which is basically the penultimate like internal form, because it takes Tai Chi, Bagua, and Xingyi and puts them together. That's how it was told to me. And, you know, there's probably a lot of more knowledgeable people out there that can break it down. But the idea of it was watching a grandmaster do it, and then his daughter, who is also a grandmaster now, do it, and watching them do it differently. Yeah. Right? Her body moved a specific way, and his body moved a specific way.
Right.
And we were like, okay, well, which way do we do it here at the school?
Uh-huh.
Do we actually do it this way, or do we do it that way? And then it came around to, okay, well, what is it, the actual intention? What's this doing? Is this the correct transition? Is this what I'm actually trying to do, or is this something different that's happening here? Is the evolution turning into something else?
I understand what you're getting at a little better now than I did maybe 3-4 minutes ago.
Yeah. So it came to us, and the grandmaster went, well, it's whatever we want it to be.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, it's how this body works. And we talked about, like, you know, the evolution of that, and, you know, okay, well, you know, you probably would do something different if you were a 20-year-old, you know, than you would do it as a 60-year-old.
This is really interesting to me. Works. We've gone through many of these sort of, okay. So when I went off on my little tangent a couple of minutes ago, like I kind of thought one thing about what you were saying. Now I'm kind of thinking a little differently. And you know, that's why we talk. It's healthy. But we've had many of these conversations, back in the old dojo and now in the MMA gym, but like, about curriculum, about balancing, like, the kids kung fu with the kids MMA, or like, do we teach a traditional self-defense class for adults, or do we just keep it with MMA and we sort of sprinkle that, right? Like, but also at the old dojo, like, anybody who's familiar with Kenpo, like, there's like you said, a million different ways to do everything, and a lot of times ego does play a big part, and not in our dojo, which was awesome, but a lot of dojos we interacted with, it was an ego thing. And, you know, Mr. Parker didn't teach it this way. Mr. Parker taught me this way. Like, dude, I don't care. Like, I don't care. And if you say hand sword and I say chop, it's the same freaking thing. And I'm not going to change the way I've been talking for 25, 30 years because you, right? Or, you know, like, let's just take it even not even as drastic. Just, okay, we're teaching a technique. Let's just pick one out of my brain. Kimono grab is the name of one of them. You don't even need to know what I'm talking about, but it starts out, somebody grabs your kimono or your shirt with two hands, right? So there's always a counter grab of some kind where you control the grab, and then you strike because, duh, you cause pain right away. And there's this whole debate one night about, do you hit him under the elbow, or do you punch him in the stomach, or do you try to go to the chin? And it's like, dude, I don't know. Which one can you reach fastest? Like, just hit him. I don't even care. So it ended up being that one of the teachers, like, we started a technique line to just, like, hash it out. Like, and I'm sitting there in this technique, like, this is stupid, man. And one of the teachers, just to prove that he was on the same wavelength as I was, apparently, get up there and just slap me right in the face as his as his version of the strike. And then he looks at my boss and goes, see? Just see? It's just like, it doesn't matter what you teach them, right? Like, the purpose is still the same. So we ended up saying, like, look, this general motion, we'll just call it an uppercut, is what we're going to teach. Okay, cool. Right? Like, now, if you look that technique up on YouTube, first of all, you're going to get three different versions of what it's actually called.
Right.
Then you're going to get 300 versions of that very first move that I'm talking about. And you're going to see the arm in all different shapes and styles. And I spent years of my life refining people's technique on whether they should do this, that. But do you know what they're going to do when somebody grabs their lapel? They're going to freak out. They're not going to do what you said to do. And that's okay. They're going to do, like you said, what this body needs to do. And those conversations, man, when you have them and you're like, well, this person taught me this way. Yeah, but that person's 4 foot two. Like, you know, they're 65 years old and 4 foot two. Of course, they're not going to do it the same way as somebody 25 and from the wrestling team.
Right.
It's just not going to be the same. They might be doing the same exact kata. They're not going to do it the same way. And
that's actually an interesting thought, because it's when I talk to Mr. Marsden from the Phoenix Society of Historical Swordsmanship.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Richard is amazing, but he's a, I don't know, 6'2", 6'3", lanky guy.
Is he that tall? I am. Wow. I didn't realize he was that tall.
In my 5 foot frame, my 5 foot eight frame going, okay, yeah, I can't do that because I'm short, you know. But it's like he's currently now studying a manual on Japanese swordsmanship, and he's like, all this is just, you know, fiore on crack and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and
very interesting comparison.
He talked to one of the kendo guys that goes to the place, and he every once in a while goes in and plays with them, because they found steel versions of katana that they trainers, can fight with, and they fought a little bit and did their thing, and then he's like, you know, the kendo teacher was like, I'm a little angry. He's like, why? He's like, because you taught and you do a lot of techniques that I basically swore a blood oath to learn. You know? He's like, your first day. He's like, yeah, I mean, that's just how you fight with a longsword. And basically, he was like, yeah, well, those are quote unquote secret techniques in our lineage, you know, but it's here it is in this European book, you know, with a longsword. He's like, yeah, well, there's. And we had a good laugh about that. We're like,
punch is just a punch. Kick is just a kick.
I hit him with that. There's only so many ways to bend your elbow.
That's right.
And he's like, yeah, it's really cool.
Single leg is a single leg, no matter where you pick it up. Yep.
Yeah.
I love those moments, though, because it really does take, like, going through all the motions and all the steps of discovering that the punch is still just the punch. The kick is still just the kick. But you still have to, like, the way that a katana is taught to do X strike or Y strike or Z strike is still different than the way it's taught in longsword, though you can apply it the same way no matter where you come from. And we were talking about the Seki Sensei videos on YouTube of him doing the rapier and the longsword for the first time. Never even really seeing these outside of movies or film. And basically being a very foreign concept to him. And here he is, like, learning about the thumb placement on the Ricasso, where so that the cross guard doesn't catch in his kimono. Like, because the cross guard caught in his kimono. All of a sudden, now he's mm-hmm. learning about a very pivotal technique in longsword fighting, which is being able to fight with your thumb on the flat of the blade. And mm-hmm. Just doing it because he's like, man, I keep getting caught. Like, is this okay? And am I allowed to do this? Mm-hmm. Like, write in the mm-hmm. comments. Am I allowed to do this? Yes. Like, that's exactly the same kind of moment that this kendo teacher experienced. And it's just so beautiful to me. Because you do have to go through all that, you know, going through the manuals and learning about, you know, the geometry of the sword and how did they do it in this culture. And then at the end of the day, like, you just put it in your hands and you fight with it and it works.
Right.
It's so beautiful, man. Martial arts is like that. It's so great.
Right, but then again, it's traditionalism versus evolution, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
It is a spectrum, and it does have a, you know, both have a time and a place.
A Venn diagram, like, if you will.
It has to, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't evolve. Mm. So the traditionalism with evolution is actually the best way to evolve.
I love that.
Is to see what the intent was and put it with it. Now, yes, that will spark debate amongst, like, more
everybody.
If there are more than three swordsmen in a room, it'll spark a debate, right? Of how it's supposed to be, how it's supposed to be done. But that, again, the ideas of, okay, well, who wrote this? What was their frame? What was the intent? For example, the book that I was talking about, that they're learning some of the samurai techniques, and, you know, everybody says this is a secret manual,
right,
passed down from, you know, the angels and to fight the demons and et cetera, et cetera. But it's basically a set of movement in their tradition, in their lineage, we talked about nulling or voiding in Soresu. That's their style of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Their style of fighting is to not get hit, not be there where your opponent swings, and then, you know, create that. But that type of fighting is really good if you're young and spry. Right. If you're in your middle age and you're, you know, not really going to dodge the blade, then you just have to be faster than the other guy, so his blade never gets never even raises to you.
Right.
So it's like a weird dichotomy in the book. But then, like, the way I was taught, you know, the 60 and 70 year olds are always the young spry ones, and the 20 year olds are trying to catch up to them somehow. So it's like a weird, like, okay, well, that's an interesting way of teaching, but, you know, the way I was taught was to intercept everything.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of not being where it is, I intercept it so that I can execute another movement. Which is correct in some instances and not correct in other instances. You just have to, you know, pick the instance where you're actually going to do it, right? So a lot of the, again, traditionalism, evolution, they have to go hand in hand, because you're not going to fight the same guy the same way twice, right? What is that proverb?
You're the proverb guy.
You can't step in the same river twice, because you have changed and so has the river.
Oh, that's not what I thought we were stepping in twice. I'll just put it to you that way. But yeah. Your point is well made.
Yeah, the idea is basically, like, if, and this is why I like lightsabers, is because you're not forced to have the same rapier duel. You're not forced to have the same longsword, you know, set. When I talk to old people that have fought each other for going on decades now, they're like, we fought each other so many times that we know when my partner is going into a fake. We know that's fake, And then we move into another thing. We know that's fake. Then we move into our third thing and, ooh, that might be something. You know what I mean? So it's very hard to surprise your old sparring partner, right? Especially if you,
yeah,
you have the same, especially if you have the same lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the thing. Like when the old masters watch, right, a lot of them are looking for the essence of what they've taught in certain things, and they like to be surprised, but not in the way where you just change their whole art.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So like if I were to see somebody, you know, doing kung fu, I love seeing, you know, somebody doing a monkey flip and coming up and scratching their ear and then, you know, coming back and doing
thing.
And then,
by the way, me too. One of my favorite things to watch, by the way.
Yeah. But like when I watch some of these wushu athletes and they're, you know, jumping, flipping in the air and landing in the splits, I'm like, that's amazing. I would never do that.
Right.
So because there's a difference in what they're doing. So there it's a difference of the traditional form where you can see like, oh, that's very recognizable. And then freestyle, which is like, it's all right. I mean, I can see all the compulsory pieces. It's like watching a gymnastics performance or an ice skating performance. All the composites are there, but it's the expression of that movement in each person. That's really, you know, how the wushu is scored. So I actually spoke to one of my grandmasters who had the opportunity to go to China with another grandmaster, and his whole thing was like, yeah, they just happened to have the Beijing World Championships just happened to be, you know, going on when they were in China. And Grandmaster Jin Hung was like, let's just pop in, see what's going on. And because the guy can walk anywhere, right? He can walk anywhere that says Wushu on it, and everybody knows who he is. And so they went, and one of my other grandmasters, who is American, is sitting there just like, okay, we're just following Grandmaster Jin Hung. And he went into the Beijing World Nationals, you know, for Wushu. And he was like, oh, hey, how's it going, Grandmaster Jung? Please come here, sit, judge. And he's like, no, I don't want to judge. He's like, who's this? He's like, oh, this is my student. Oh, can he judge? And so they're like, oh, yeah, sure. And they explained how they did stuff. So they would actually film what's going on the floor. And they'd have a monitor on their table. And they'd replay the form. Mm-hmm. And they would take that replay and they'd take out a ruler and they'd see if the alignments were correct on the body and the stances. And they'd check to see if, you know, if they in the air, their leg is tucked or if their back was straight, they'd take a ruler to it and measure stuff. And they counted, they basically created a composite score based on all the things that they saw. And they asked my teacher, who said basically, they're like, oh, how do Americans do it? He was like, I don't know what the heck you guys are doing. Everybody starts at a 10 and then we deduct points.
That's exactly how I do it personally.
Yeah. And they were doing it the opposite direction where it was like you gain points to do it. But yeah, it was a very interesting like way to look at it. You could build up or you can take away, but everybody's working toward 10.
Right. Yeah.
And so it was very much the same kind of, okay, there's a traditional way where your knee has to be as low as your hip, your thigh has to be parallel to the ground, your back has to be straight, you know, all that stuff. But in the end, they're trying to work to the number 10. They're all trying to get a plastic medal.
Yeah. You know? Yes. So, yes.
And that's not something that you would have every year, you know, traditionally. Yeah. It's more of a, that's more of a modern thing.
Well, let's, we're already kind of talking like a little bit about, I need to eat the microphone a little bit. We're already kind of talking about what I wanted to talk about tonight. Not precisely, but we're dancing around it, with this traditional mm-hmm. versus, what was the word you used? Evolution, we'll say, or freestyle or modern or mm-hmm. whatever. And you know, SMA, the whole idea is it's MMA, just mm-hmm. with a sword of a sort. Mm-hmm. There was something that you said that I really, my brain's going in so many different directions right now. Like you've really sort of unlocked some synapses right now.
Sure.
But, oh, the scoring is particularly interesting to me because that idea of going up, like you're probably familiar with this in a lot of tournaments. Judges will like have a short, they always have like a judges meeting or a black belt, you know, meeting prior to the whole event taking place, or sometimes a couple times, mm-hmm. but usually before each individual ring does its thing, the judges for that particular division will have a short little meeting. Okay, we're going to score every kid or every competitor 7 to 10. Like nobody gets a score lower than 7. 7's basically 0. So, you know, that, or whatever the range they chose for that day. Mm-hmm. And it really changes how you look at things depending on what the spread of how, in other words, how much you're either going to deduct or add to the score. Like if it's a particularly tight division, like black belt divisions, they would usually score those 8.5 or 9 to 10. Like, and nobody would get a 10. So it was 9.9 would be the absolute highest score you could possibly get. Mm-hmm. And like right away, I just said nobody would get a 10. Like just right there, there's a difference in philosophy, right? Like,
right.
But then if you go to an MMA match or a boxing match, an official MMA or boxing match, everything is scored either 10 or 9. Like,
right.
Yeah, if you don't screw up worse than the other guy, you're getting a 10.
Right.
Or girl. And the only way you're not getting a 10 is some sort of foul or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if you don't win the round, right? So,
right.
And if in order for you to get less than 9, you got to really screw up really pretty badly. 10-8 in a round is considered like you really got your butt handed to you. 10-7 is nearly unheard of. You almost never, ever. It has happened, but you almost never see it. And 10-6, like, you're out of the organization. Like, that's not, I've never even heard of it. Maybe it's happened. But, yeah, they call that a 10-9 must system. Basically, if you don't win, you get 9 points. If you win, you get 10 points each round. And that 8, that 7 thing, that's like basically the judges are telling you, like, you got to finish the person in order to win this fight now.
Right.
Or you could end up tying the person if you're coming from behind and you end up having a particularly awesome performance in one of the rounds. You can end up, you know, putting the score more in your favor. But anyway, there's just, right there, we just discussed three different ways to score things. And then, like I was saying, in a black belt division, you might only have 1 point. So now you're dealing in tenths of a point, right? Like, that you're, like, you're splitting hairs on. But with a black belt division, like, it's the respectful thing to do to, like, split those hairs and make it about tenths of a point. Like, a 9.1, I would feel awful getting a 9.1. Just, by the way, I don't mean to make anybody feel awful. But personally, if I practiced for, let's just say, months to compete in a tournament that I'm paying money to compete in, by the way, and I'm practicing a form, let's just say, or I'm practicing my sparring, my point fighting, or my continuous fighting, and like I don't want to go in there and get like basically A1, because if they're scoring, and look, if I'm in a black belt division, or let's just say I'm in, you know, if it's saber fighting, like a Rancor division, right? Like an advanced division. I don't want to get a one. I don't want to get a one. I am in here because it was competitive, right? It was a competitive area, and I want to get a competitive number. You know, if you're not getting at least a five or higher, you're not even in the conversation. And as a judge of some of those divisions, you are literally splitting hairs. You're like, holy crap, that person was good. I'm giving them a 9.6. And then you see somebody who's like almost as good, and you're like, okay, that's a 9.4. And then you see somebody who's right in between. You're like, I got my 9.5. But then you see somebody who's sort of like could be any of those, and you're like, oh crap, I got to work out these numbers a little bit. Like, or maybe somebody's just excellent, and you're like, oh my gosh, it can't get better. I'm giving them a 9.9. And then all of a sudden, somebody is better. You're like, holy crap. And now you got two 9.9. Now they're going, you get to see both of them again, because there's got to be a tiebreaker or something like that. I actually kind of like those situations, though, because it forces the judges and the competitors to both split hairs in the moment. And that's what real fighting is, right? Like the details at a very fast pace in the moment, and being able to slow those details down to a workable tempo while outworking your opponent. So let's kind of get, I want to read, where did you find this quote that you sent us?
Actually, it was posted. You know what? I don't remember, but I want to say it was posted on one of the many groups I have due to martial arts on Facebook. I want to say it was Sticks and Steel. I could be wrong. Edit this part out if it isn't.
It looks like it's from a magazine or a book or something like that.
Yeah, but somebody put it down, and it was an Arnie's practitioner that obviously saw an article about their grandmaster. They took a picture of it and then shared it. Okay, online, right?
So I want to read this. It's just a couple of short paragraphs, and I do want to read it, but it has a lot to do with what we've been talking about in a very different way. But it's going to be very, you know, if you're a saber fighter and you've already been listening to this point 40 minutes in, first of all, thank you. Second of all, this part is going to be, in my opinion, very useful to you. I hope it will. I hope the conversation ends up being useful to you. But this quote is about basically in the moment how competition versus tradition can collide and also coalesce, if you will. So I guess whoever is doing the interview or writing the article asks the question to the grandmaster of an Arnis school, right? Could you give us your opinion on how Arnis should be promoted, whether as a sport or a combat art? Also, what do you think of the tournament rules being used presently? By the way, does this sound familiar to anybody who's been in the lightsaber community for any amount of time, right? Does that whole paragraph not like pluck a few of your strings? Okay, so the Grandmaster answers. For Arnis to become popular, it has to be promoted as a sport, but we have to make sure we never lose its combat origin and application, aka tradition, right? I'm putting that word in myself. As for tournament rules currently being used, we had an incident in Nisipit, Agassan. I don't know if I pronounced that right. Sorry if I didn't. That was for a moment embarrassing. So they had an incident at this town tournament, and he said that for a moment, it was an embarrassing incident. We had a major tournament, and there were a lot of foreigners from Japan and America who came to see the fights. The players were all were wearing all sorts of protective gear and were careless and overconfident as they charged and attacked with utter disregard for defense or strategy. Does that also sound familiar to anybody listening? They just kept hammering at each other without any art or form. The foreign guests were so disappointed. This was not the Arnis they heard about or came to see. They protested and wanted their money back. We immediately changed the rules and stripped the players of their excessive protective gear. Told them to take their gear off. The combative form of Arnis emerged and the tournament was successful. Everybody was happy as they saw the art of Arnis being practiced and demonstrated in its true combat form. The absence or reduction of protective gear, that's important because, you know, you do want to promote a certain level of safety. The absence or reduction of protective gear may seem to make the art brutal. It really does not. It makes the practitioner more careful and serious about the art. I 100% agree, by the way. They train better and more diligently, for they know that a single strike could mean victory or defeat. They also have more respect for their opponent's skills and courage. On the overall, having tournaments in its proper combat setting brings out the true, dedicated, and disciplined practitioners of the art. Okay, so to summarize, TLDR. They had a tournament. People were geared up like Knights of the Round Table for a stick fighting tournament. And by the way, Arnis sticks, they hurt when you get hit by them, but they are made of bamboo. They are not the hardest items in the world. You can get hit by them to a relatively, you know, controlled degree and without gear and still be okay. So they had a tournament. People were geared up. And they're whacking the crap out of each other. No form, no function. Why even take martial arts if you're not even going to use any of the technique that I taught you, right? So they strip all this gear off, and basically they're forced to what I would call shadow spar, right? We've heard of shadow boxing where you're using your imagination to spar an opponent. But if you have a live opponent there and you have no gear and you're forced to use control, but you're still forced to use technique and actual martial arts, man, whoo. That's called shadow sparring in my school, and that's called control. You have to have it. Otherwise, you're going to screw each other up, right? So because you don't want to get messed up, you're using kid gloves with the other person to some degree. At the same time, what they found was people were actually using their real techniques. And Alan, when I fought with Eric, you, anybody of the school heads for the first time, mm-hmm. all we wore was gloves, and I probably shouldn't even say this on the air, but I'm going to. We didn't even wear helmets at the time.
Right.
Automatically, it was like we were not really testing. We kind of knew, but already automatically, like our version of shaking hands was like, I trust that if you're not wearing the gear and I'm not wearing the gear, that we're going to express martial arts to each other for the next, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. We're not going to hurt each other. And right. We are expressing concepts and motions and physicality and emotions that mean they're an analog of hurting each other, mm-hmm. but we are not doing so. We are just playing. And mm-hmm. the karate nerd recently, I don't know if it was you that sent me that video, talking about playing and sparring. I think it was Kate that sent it to me maybe. Talking about when you're sparring, when you're training, he used the Cuban boxing team as an example. He's like, they're always playing, they're dancing when they're sparring. They're like talking to each other and laughing and cracking jokes and mm-hmm. practicing real technique, head movement, footwork, right? Like, mm-hmm. that's what emerges. Yes, we know you can crack each other. And in to use stick fighting or lightsabers, we know you can hit each other hard as crap with a bulletproof blade. We know it. Mm-hmm. But that's not the point. For me, at least, the point is to practice my sword martial arts with this cool fantasy thing that I've always loved since I was a boy. Right. To practice the technique. And when you have somebody where you're forced, I use the example of not wearing helmets with the master, so to speak. It's just, mm-hmm. we're forced to like use our technique. If I want to stab you towards the head, I'm going to go for it. But at the same time, like, I'm not going to actually stab you in the head because I know that I could hit you in the eye. I know it. But I'm going to make that motion because I respect you enough to use the techniques that I've been taught, right? Like, there's this level of coming up to the level of competition too. Like, I don't know, man. It's this weird martial arts thing where, like, your way of respecting somebody is to actually fight them to the best of your ability. But that doesn't mean to the strongest of your power or to the fastest of your speed. That means you show them the cool techniques. You show them the stuff you've been practicing. You show them the workhorse techniques that always get you points, because that's going to force them to adapt to you. You're going to be forced to it. That's how things evolve and get better. Use that evolve word again. I don't know. Riff, Alan, go.
Well, the reason that we did what we did is because there was a level of trust there, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But it was a level of trust without competition.
Like self-competition almost, where you're just saying, can I hang with you? Let's find out.
Yeah. The competition was with ourselves,
yes,
not with.
Yes. And know, very petty. And I say that in a good way. Very petty.
Yeah. It's basically, can I make what I've been practicing with work against, you know, my highly respected friend who probably has an answer for it.
Yeah. Yes. You know? And I want to see his answer for it. Cause
I unfortunately I can't literally fight myself just yet.
Yes. You know, exactly.
But when the solar eclipse came, I was looking for my double, and you know, they didn't challenge me to do it, so we kind of had a sandwich and moved on. But when we're actually doing things like that, the reason that we had that was because we understood a lot of what we were doing was creating a new tradition, kind of. You know, we took what we knew and what we did, and you know, we faced off in a traditional sense, and we created this thing where it's like, okay, well, we know that we trust each other enough to not, you know, take out each other's eyes. We're not actually going to do that. We're actually going to try to do this other thing, this whole other way of fighting, so that we can express our art to another practitioner of the art and see, you know, how their art interplays with my art.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of what high level practitioners used to do in any martial tradition, is they actually weren't there to kill each other. They're
Stop. In sparring, you're not supposed to knock people out. Stop.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not supposed to actually break his arm in jiu-jitsu class. Ugh.
Right. So what you were describing is the gladiator pit, which is all well and good if you wanted to live the life of a slave.
Yeah.
But it's not actually something.
Yeah, your mouth guard is not actually there to protect your teeth from getting knocked out. People don't realize that. That's like it. It's there to show the other person, please don't knock out my teeth. Yeah. I'm going to put this rubber thing in the way to pretend that it's going to protect me so that you remember not to hit me as hard as you possibly can.
Right.
In a real fight, it's there to prevent your teeth from getting knocked out because they're going to hit you as hard as they possibly can. But apples to oranges.
And now we're talking once again, like even like the gladiators, awesome. You know, they did great, but they did not fight like the Spartans, right, who were soldiers.
Exactly.
Their stakes were different.
Yes, and their numbers were different. I mean, that's...
And their numbers were different.
That's
right.
In and of itself, like, why... If I'm not worried about, like, arrows and things, right? Like, why am I wearing all this gear that covers every joint, right? Everything for a saber fight, like a friendly fight. Now, I realize in tournaments and stuff where when you don't have people you know that maybe you're competing against... Alan, this has been something that you harp for your own personal safety and people that you train with. Like, you're wearing that armor because you don't know what kind of mook is going to walk through the door and hit you with a lightsaber.
Exactly.
So there's a balance to be had there for sure.
Yeah. You don't know how hard somebody hits or what kind of day they've had. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah.
But in general training, you know, it shouldn't really be more complicated than... I mean, we can get into the nuances, but in its most basic form, I mean, a helmet, gloves, maybe a chest guard. Like, does it need to get more complicated than that for saber fighting?
Not necessarily. That's the thing, though, is we do accidents do happen.
Sure, of course.
But in competition, like what you described earlier, when what we did before was
playtime,
not in competition. Playtime. It was playtime. It was
workshopping. Velocities, yeah, if you want to use the Star Wars terminology, basically, right. You know, practice fighting.
We were doing velocities and Dulan in a way to
at kind fight of pace. One. Yeah.
Yeah, and we weren't trying to, you know.
I should post some of these videos. I gotta find them. They're from Steve's Google Drive, but
right.
I might have some of these videos.
We talked about this before, but that sort of camaraderie is what we started Saber Martial Arts.
That's
for,
exactly
right?
Why.
Is to create that. So competition is one thing, but camaraderie is another.
Yes.
Right. And the whole idea of, well, like you were talking about the Cuban boxing team. It's like, yeah, we're talking as we're doing it. It might as well have been the chatty duel in the Princess Bride, because we're sitting there going, hey, check this out, you know, okay, oh, that was pretty cool, all right, try it again, okay, oh, here's my answer for it, okay, cool. And we kept on doing that because we're not actually trying to get to a certain number of points.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to do that. We're workshopping, playing, you know, sharing our art with each other. Now, if there is a competition, that you gotta at least have some sort of rule set to adhere to, right? And the yes. most fair rule set that kind of splits the difference between traditionalism and efficacy and in competition, I find, is one with proper gear, you know,
sure.
where you're actually protecting yourself from any errant head strikes. And because this is a polycarbonate blade, it will bend before it breaks your bone, but it'll right. still hurt. It'll still bruise.
Yeah.
There are certain things like thrusts that do happen. You know, and certain rule sets are basically Nick's thrusts. Because of the equipment.
Dude, there's some cat in this room or something. I don't know. It's got a frog in its throat. Boo, sorry.
But that takes away a lot of techniques, right?
And that's where the balance of the art comes in. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I mean, but like. Yeah, that's why I keep saying boo. I just admitted it was me. It wasn't a cat. like I'm always, this is why I wear MMA gloves in MMA sparring and not boxing gloves like half the people. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. If you train MMA, stop wearing boxing gloves in sparring. Stop it. Don't do it. It's training you incorrectly for the sport you're in. This is a whole other conversation, but hey man, I'm telling you right now, stop it. Get yourself a pair of open finger gloves so that you can actually practice mixed martial arts, not just freaking kickboxing, okay? And also, you're going to get your face cut up, your bell rung, CTE, whatever you want to call it, if you rely on those pillows to protect your head in sparring, and then all of a sudden you're forced into a situation in a fight where you either have tiny or no gloves. Start training with 6-ounce gloves, and train with control so that you don't cut your partners in training, and everybody will be happier. And you will be a better fighter because of exactly what we're talking about right now. I'm a big fan, to take it back to the stab situation, I'm a big fan of putting all the viable techniques into a rule set. All the viable techniques, aside from like groin shots, back of the head, joint breaks, stuff like that. Like, unless that's the art you're in. But like... I'm a fan of putting everything in and having a safety contingency for it. If you feel that a technique is quote unquote too dangerous for a fighting sport, then I'm sorry, you should not be fighting sports. You just shouldn't. This is maybe not the, and that's okay. Like, it's not for everybody, by the way.
Right.
And not everybody has to be a fighter, but hey, man, I'm a fan. Okay, again, if you're listening and you change your rules to adapt, okay, it's okay. Like, I think about Tony and Aiken Saber Academy, but he trains with various rule sets because he knows there's value in all different kinds of techniques and things and some rule sets. Mm-hmm. But that's my point. Have a mechanism in place to train these different things and to test these different things. And if your one rule set is not that, then come up with different ways so that people can experience all these techniques, because I find it not just limiting, but also unrealistic and sort of disrespectful to not just your students or yourself, but to the people you're competing against, if you don't have a mechanism in place to demonstrate all of the art.
Right. So this is kind of where the rubber meets the road, right? Because
this is where gear comes in, right? Like,
this is the biggest one of the biggest contentions of most saber martial arts competitions come into play, because there is a gamut from just gloves as far as gear is concerned, all the way to, you know,
some people not even just gloves
armored up.
Yeah. Right. And some people in Europe fight with sharp swords. So I don't know.
Yeah, right. And but the thing is, like, there are certain things and certain technologies, and, you know, is it the weapon? You know, what kind of blade is it? You know, is it, you know, the thickness of the blade, the flexibility of the blade, the length of the blade, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. When you're doing any sort of thrusting, does matter. Right. So if there is legitimate danger there, I understand. Don't thrust. However, you know, that might not be the flavor to display all the sword fighting styles.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and Alan, this is something that just has driven me nuts for a long time. You know it. Mm-hmm. Is when they're what I would call obscene gear requirements, yet there are limits to the techniques. So, like, where you have people, like I said, armored up like a knight of the round table, ready to go out and face a barrage of arrows, let alone sabers made of plastic, albeit a very tough plastic. If you already have like a chest protector, let's just say, on your gear requirements, why are you outlawing thrusts? Like, outlaw loss of control. That's really what it comes down to. If you have safety requirements, outlaw people breaching the safety requirements. And part of that is, I'm looking right now, Alan, at our six maybe year old equipment glossary, and it's been added to and subtracted from, and this is more of a guideline for anybody in SMAF or we've talked to who didn't really have a handle on their safety requirements, and it's very cut and dry. This is not even like many of our schools and affiliates have required more than what we have listed here, which is fine. They also require, or they also allow, pretty much all techniques. But right here, you're required to have head, hands, shoes, which is just to say, like, you can't have bare feet unless that's you're in the dojo or something and bare feet are required. And then chest protection. Then we have a whole bunch of things that are recommended, right? Like a cup, which in some places is required, leg, like shin guards or knee guards, you know, forearm and elbow protection. These are just a gorget, which in a lot of places is required as well, which is neck protection. But right in the first paragraph, it says, like, you can't be a you know what CK about things. Mm-hmm. You can't be a total butthead about how you're hitting people. Like, use control, use martial arts. and be in control of your martial arts. And then, correct. So it befalls upon the judge to say, you already have this gear, you know the techniques, why are you, you know, if you're hitting somebody way too hard, screw three strikes, you're out. Like, if it's really bad the first time, that's it. You make an example of that person right away.
So again, that's traditionalism.
Yeah.
You know, versus sportification again.
Yeah.
There are also gear requirements, as in the length of the blade and the length of the hilt.
The thickness of the wall of the blade. Big deal. Big deal.
Well, I mean, maximizing their sword length, you know, with detriment to their actual fighting style, and things of that nature. When we're talking about, gear, part of it is the weapon, right? Gear, the weapon is gear as well. In some rule sets, you are encouraged to grab the end of your pommel in order to get that extra little bit of reach, you know, with a sacrifice to your actual martial technique.
Right.
And then there's certain other rule sets that tell you have to arm, which basically means that you have to have right of way in order to actually score a point.
In many martial arts, we'd call that telegraphing, which is a detriment to your martial tech. But in certain, like fencing, which is a sportified version of sword fighting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's like a if, when, but.
All right. So it depends on your flavor. It depends on what it is that you like. You know, we all agree we like this type of thing, but what is the tradition you want to follow, right? So people ask all the time about martial arts, like, hey, what should I get my kid into? And my automatic answer is anything.
Yeah.
Right? Because once you try it, you can see what's good in it and you can see what's bad in it. And you can actually, you know, just make your own decision from there.
Mm-hmm.
There are literally 5 schools within a block of where I live.
Yeah.
But there's, it just so happens to be serendipitous that the school that I go to, that I've been going to for years and teaching and being a part of and part of that community, happens to be a mile away from my son's daycare. So guess where I'm taking my son?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So that just happens to be serendipitous. Now, if, you know, my son's daycare was somewhere else, would I have picked a different place? Maybe. You know, but it just so happens in this universe that's it worked out well that, you know, my extended kung fu family is actually teaching my son how to do kung fu. So that's just kind of how it works. It wasn't, you know, it's not, I'm not taking my son to work. I'm taking them to, you know, Uncle Jerry's house, you know, to punch and kick. So it's one of those things that, because of the nature of what we do and how we teach, that tradition is usually what that keeps people there.
Yeah.
Right. The sensationalism, the sportification, all that stuff is great to get people started, but the tradition is what keeps people there and coming back.
Let's talk about this a little bit. You mentioned kids and again, we're talking about sport versus tradition. I'll talk a little bit about the kids MMA class I teach.
Sure.
To keep it on the gear vein a little bit with all of this topic, this is a thick topic. We only require, okay, when I grew up in karate class, we had to wear foot protection, hand protection. I believe this is all the same now. Chest guard or rib protection if you were a little kid, because chest guard was huge on you. Rib guard or chest guard, helmet, and eventually they required that helmet to have a polycarbonate face shield. We used to fight without the face shield. They eventually required it. And mouth guard. Mouth guard's absolutely your most important part of safety equipment, bar none. So that was five things: feet, hands, chest, head, teeth. Now, cup was also required, but I never wore one. I'll just be honest with you. I hate them. And unless the ref or whoever is actually going to make me knock on my crotch to prove it, I'm not wearing it. That's not an excuse for anybody who meets me to kick me in the nuts. But now with the kids class, we require shin guards, gloves, and they use 10-ounce boxing gloves. I don't like it. I wish we used MMA gloves, but it wasn't my choice. Sometimes I have them take them off for grappling and stuff. So that's it. That's all they wear. Two items. They don't even wear the mouth guard. They don't wear head protection. And that's because, here I'm going to eat my words a little bit about outlawing techniques. We don't let them hit each other in the head at all. Until they're like maybe 13-ish, they can go like contact to the head. But if they're in that class, the 13 and under class, zero head contact whatsoever. Now, when they're wrestling, grappling, stuff like that, obviously they're doing cross faces, their elbows or forearms might be resting on somebody's chin or pushing on the side of their face and so forth. But it's kind of like this Arnice quote where my boss has seen over the years that when he gave them the equipment, they were hitting each other in the head too hard at a young age.
Right.
And I kind of saw that too. Now in the old dojo, when we required them to have five, it's still not even that much, honestly, five foam pieces of equipment, basically, they still weren't allowed to hit each other in the head until they were brown belts. That's like really high up. You're waiting a long time to hit each other in the head. But they were allowed to make light contact in drills and things with punches to the head at slightly lower belts. So like you kind of, and then of course, if you're a black belt or you're in the adult class, like anything goes, don't be a butthead. Practice your martial arts. So it's just a matter of like two different cultures, two different geographies, but still trying to accomplish the same thing in a slightly different way. Like now the way I teach, I have to quote unquote outlaw techniques. They can still do all the techniques they know. They just can't do them to the head. But how hard is it to change a target zone later, right? And if that's what you're concerned about with saber fighting, like use the piece of, like, let's just use thrust again. Okay, I might be concerned about thrust to the throat. Okay, so no thrust to the throat, fine. But if you're wearing a fencing mask, why can't you thrust to the face, right? Like, if you're wearing a plastic or a hard foam chest guard and it's a blunt tip lightsaber, like, why can't you thrust with control to the chest, right? Conversely, if you take that helmet off, maybe don't thrust to the face. I feel like there's a common sense, like level ground here, where regulation meets just normal revelation, like where putting a provision in place so that you don't get your eyes poked out. Sometimes you just don't poke somebody's eyes out. I don't know if I'm being clear about this, but I know what I mean to say.
Yeah. So a lot of the stuff that we've talked about tonight is basically that, right? What you just said. It's the sportification of it is simulated combat, right?
Yeah.
And I think you and I have talked at length about being able to put all types of sword style combat underneath the biggest umbrella.
Yeah, right? Sure.
And in order to do that, you have to sportify it a little bit. Otherwise, people will literally get hurt, you know?
Yeah, well, so, and it also gives you that pressure test that we all like as martial artists.
Yeah. And that way it's not, you know, because you've held the Action Flex foam weapons that my teacher makes, right?
So they're amazing.
And you can go full speed, full strength, you know, as long as you're not cracked in the ear, you're going to be okay. Yeah. Even if you're thrusted, you know, if you take a full-on thrust to the chest, it's going to be okay unless you somehow got the perfect angle into your solar plexus. Now, is it going to make a loud noise and scare the bejesus out of you? Yes, but you're going to look around and go, "Oh, I'm okay," because it was it's a good product. Now, there are other foam weapons in the world that I do not trust with that level of safety.
Correct. Right? Oh, and by the way, Action Flex has also gone through at least two iterations of their own headgear specifically designed for Action Flex, even because even as safe as they are, you can still screw each other up pretty badly.
Yeah. And this is what I mean is like that you have to work really, really hard and hit something that you're not supposed to hit in order to break one of those things.
But people do that in tournament. I know you're just kind of what you're getting at too. Like people do that. And that's kind of what we're saying. Mm-hmm. Please stop being that person. Please stop being that person.
Or at least be honest about it.
Yeah.
At least be honest. That
we have some guys in MMA and they will tell you like, you probably shouldn't go with me. I'm in a mood tonight, or look, I got a fight coming up. I'm going hard. So if you're going to tap gloves with me, we're going hard. I'm not going hard. I'm good. Thanks for telling me. Yeah, exactly. At least you're being honest. I much appreciate it.
And that's the thing, right? There is a time and a place. And again, even there, right? Let's even talk about that. The most popular open hand form of combat sport. Right now, is the UFC and the ONE Championship and all the other types of championships. Sure,
absolutely. It's not even a contest for the next most popular.
But you know, they all have a ring and two people punching, kicking, and grappling. Right, and but they still wear gloves. They still
have mouth guards.
They have mouth guards. They still have a ref that stops the fight immediately.
And there's about five things you still can't do, about five techniques that are outlawed. That's just off the top of my head.
Right. And this is what I'm saying is like, as soon as you put competition in it and it's not your,
it's no longer about war or protecting your life in that moment.
Right. It becomes a different story.
Yeah.
And the art has to evolve if you want to do that, which is okay if, again, my opinion, it's okay for the art to evolve as long as it's still the art. Mm. Once it changes into something else, then is it still okay to call it that, right? So when, we need to create a new name for it. If it no longer looks like the source material,
right.
So, for example, and again, this is my opinion. It's not thing. It is XMA, extreme martial arts. You know, is that combat fighting? And to me, I'm like, no.
Yeah,
it's a show.
Tricking is another term for it. If people aren't sure what you're talking about.
Yeah, tricking, doing anything. It's so, you know, once you do it, it's like it's kind of like how they for some reason, and I don't know the evolution of this, and forgive me if I seem ignorant or disrespectful or both. There's a difference between gymnastics and rhythmic gymnastics.
Right. Yeah, I don't actually know. I would never have even thought about it.
and the difference is the apparatus, as far as I can see. Because in rhythmic gymnastics, the apparatus moves with you. In normal gymnastics, the apparatus stands still and you move around it.
Mm.
That's as far as I can understand. But I still like watching both of them. It's great because it's a different type of athleticism, right? But there's a lot of stuff that I know I sure as hell can't do. I can't do the crazy balance beam stuff or the hanging rings and
right.
things like that. I've never in my life been trained a single minute of that stuff. But I can respect it. I can see it. Now, the tricking and the jumping, flipping, sideways and landing in the splits and catching your sword behind your back while you do it, man, I'm all about it. That looks so cool. Would I ever do it in a fight? No. there is something to be said about showmanship and that. There's all this stuff in Cirque du Soleil that I'm just like, that just takes some dedication and some work and to do it. But, those are all different types of sports, right?
Yeah.
That are expressions of the human body. And so is martial arts, right? It's an expression of the human body. I separate the martial arts, which is the art part, the wushu, to the combat, which is a whole nother story, right? That's a different
yeah.
aspect. And then there's the sports, which is another aspect. So insofar as I've been rambling,
the tradition, man, this is SMAFcast, this is what we do around here.
The tradition that you pick, whatever it may be, whether it's karate, judo, jujitsu, jicho, bokashi, whatever.
Yes.
If whatever you're doing and you want to put it into a rule set, whatever your tradition is, your martial art is, and you put it into the sport or the combat, those look different because there are certain things that have to change in order for it to be sportified, and there's certain things that have to be changed in order for it to be combat. But at the same time, if you're just celebrating your art, right, there's a celebration of art versus yeah. a competition of art.
That's sort of near and dear to my yeah. heart and the way I like to think of SMA and the way I like to think of what we do.
Right.
Because
right. I think I explained that to somebody once, and I forget who it was, but they asked me, like, why, what is it that makes saber martial arts different than saber martial arts events different than other events? And I was like, well, we don't really compete. And that kind of that put them like in a weird, like, what? I don't understand. But you call it a tournament. It's like, yes, but because if you see it as a competition, then you'll train like it's a competition against somebody else. We want to celebrate our art yeah. so that the only person we really defeat is our previous self. And because we celebrate our art with our friends who are also celebrating their art, we can see who that day, that one exchange, has actually practiced a little bit more.
Well, and it's that
who can share it.
It's that congruent mm-hmm. sense of culture. You'll hear about culture in all kinds of avenues of life, business, in particular mm-hmm. business or religion, or in our case, martial arts. It's a big topic is gym culture or dojo culture, one to the next and between them and such. And obviously, you and I come from a similar dojo culture. Kay comes from a similar dojo culture. Courtney and these people, Steve comes from that same type of culture, but from the business side. And then he incorporated that into martial arts and San Diego Sabres and things like that. The point being, this is near and dear to my heart because, I'll just use my Holocron videos that we've been going over and stuff. For example, some of the stuff in there, it's teaching you my martial arts of the lightsaber, my saber martial arts, But at the same time, like, a lot of it you could use in sparring. Or some of it, though, is just like, if you think about it, like, okay, if a Sith attacked me, like, on the streets of Coruscant, like, well, how would I defend myself against it? But, like, that's okay. Like, obviously, nobody's ever going to really attack your life with a real lightsaber. You're never actually going to have one on you when your life depends on it. Like, you might, right. But that's okay. Like, you're still learning this application, right? Like, mm-hmm. And maybe one day, just in a weird turn of events, like, you have a broomstick in your hand, let's say, when you do have to defend yourself against a real attacker of some kind, and you happen to do just like some kind of saber martial arts thing. I don't know, right? You do a move you did in longsword class. Like, those are that's where that tradition and evolution and all that collides again. And just because some, you know, 18th century sword master wrote it down in his S's look like F's or whatever, doesn't mean that you can't still use that same technique or that same concept or that same intention in whatever way you need it in whatever moment now in 2024. So I don't know, man. This conversation, I feel like it's so open-ended. I mean, there's so many places we could go with it. Some, maybe we should just table it for now, but like, I mean, such a good, it's a lot to consider. And I think that for people who are competing, they need to consider it. You need to consider the rules that are required. You need to look at techniques and things that you're allowed to do when you go compete. You need to look at the culture of the school that's holding the event or the people they're inviting, and, you know, do your homework, because having been in the martial arts for so long, having been in the competitive scene, you know, as both a coach and a competitor and just an observer as well, as a judge, and you, like, there's so many things that you really have to learn how to filter the BS and how to filter the good and how to retain what is useful and dismiss what is not useful, or whatever you want to say. That was a horrible accent. But look, there's so much BS everywhere you go. Mm-hmm. Martial arts is no different. As a matter of fact, it's I would say in many ways probably worse. And saber martial arts, being that a lot of people who claim to be showing you real, quote unquote, real sword fighting or real lightsaber fighting or real saber arts or whatever. If they're calling it saber martial arts, they better be involved with us. but anyway, if they're doing that, look at the product, look at what you're dealing with.
Right.
You know, we looked at each other over time and found that our product was something that we agreed with amongst each other, something that we thought was valuable, you know, and each person was allowed to do it their own way, but their own way, we felt that it matched up with our core values and what have you, our culture, mm-hmm. As it were. And that's not the case with everybody, and that's okay, because their core values don't match up with ours. That's okay. They can do their thing. But what I guess what we've been dancing around is, you, as a person, as a saber fighter, as a martial artist, as just a human being, you have to weigh all these things out. You have to look at all these things and decide what's right for you. Personally, if I'm going to compete in a tournament and wear a bunch of gear that's required, I expect that techniques will be used both against me and in my favor. All techniques. And if I'm told not, I probably won't compete in that competition again, just because that's not my values. But
sure,
that doesn't mean that what they're doing is invalid or that it's not valuable to somebody else. And honestly, I'll attend those things too. Like, just if I don't agree, that's fine. I'll still go. I might like it a lot. Tony's from Aiken Saber Academy, Tony's sits style of mm-hmm. training. I don't want to say I don't agree with it, but definitely not the way I've trained my students. But I think it's pretty cool because he's given a certain demographic something to latch onto with it. And also, it's kind of fun. I've watched people use it in, you know, other tournaments just in downtime and stuff. And they're smiling and laughing the whole time. That's what I like to see. Mm-hmm. So for me, sure. Yeah. And Tony, if you're listening, any day you wanna show me what to do, man, I'm here. Sits me down, as it were. I don't know, man. This is a topic that's a hot topic for me, and I like having the gear debate. I really do. I was debating somebody, this Mike Tyson, Jake Paul box. Can't even believe I just said that on there. I don't even want to talk about it. But this boxing match that's going to be on Netflix, and they're talking about using, you know, whatever ounce gloves for fighter safety. Like, dude, I'm sorry. The bigger your gloves is not safer. That is just asking for a heavier concussion. But, you know, people don't think about that their values are different than mine. You know what I mean? They value not getting cut, I guess, as much. But, you know, I value blocking my head with the technique of moving my hands and my head as opposed to just putting some pillows in front of my face and hoping that they don't hit me as hard as they can. It's a different philosophy, and it's also a different sport. I trained in karate and MMA where you had open finger gloves and you were going to be grabbing things and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, if you're training in boxing, that's a different sport. It's a different sport, and the gloves should be different because they're reflecting, like you said, reflecting the needs of the sportification of that particular aspect of combat. Pugilism in this case. Alan, give me a closing thought, and then I got a fun little thing that we'll wrap up with.
Cool. Just let's leave you with this. Decide what you like. Decide, you know, check it out. See if it's what you like. But also, whatever type of martial art you do, whatever type of saber fighting you do, if you like it, stay with it. If there's something you don't like about it, then find something else that's, you know, hopefully viable for what you like, and then let it evolve. You know, if it becomes something else, it's something else. But it's okay for you to like other things, right? Mm-hmm. There's this idea of tribalism in a lot of associations where you just want to be in this organization or this group, and you can't be in any other. They are the rivals, or they are the enemy. And that shouldn't exist when none of this really, you know, has been around for less than 100 years, right? There hasn't been even two generations since we actually have been able to start, you know, doing combative arts with polycarbonate plates.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I mean.
Two generations. I mean, we're barely completing the first generation at this point, right?
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's like there hasn't 20
years,
been a
maybe 25 at most. Right. Yeah.
So, I would say, try all of it. You know, I mean, I keep on quoting Bruce Lee. Absorb what is useful, discard the rest.
Yeah.
And then it becomes its own thing. And if it's something that just kind of coincides with your idea or your philosophy or something you want it to be, then reach out, create a community. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to have you come in and, you know, hopefully find us and talk to us and, you know, hang out with us, and let's actually celebrate the art that we're creating as we do this. And, you know, that's part of the whole thing is we want to share our art, right? Mm. Nobody is enjoying a painting that sits in a closet, right? Except for the person that knows what's in that closet. Mm. So, you know, we want to share it with the world. Let's go ahead and and reach out. Let's make community. Let's have some camaraderie. And, you know, if competition is your thing, maybe that's where you create the community. If combat is your thing, maybe that's where you create the camaraderie. Sure. Maybe just the art is where it's at. And you know what? That's a great place too. You know, if you're into saber spinning and you're not into hitting anybody with your saber or getting hit by a saber, great. Start there. Create a community. There are people out there like you, I swear.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sifu Segue.
Yeah.
Here we are again in a beautiful transition made by Master Venable. the community at large, first of all, check us out on all the different medias, sabermartialarts.life, of course. This podcast is available everywhere. Usually we're out, I'll say by Thursday every week, but our Tuesday, Wednesday is our goal every week to have an episode out. So, you know, at least we've been pretty good about once a week, at most once every 2 weeks, you get an episode of Smavcast. And sometimes we've got videos that we've done. We've got educational videos, sparring footage. Reach out to us. SaberMAOutreach@gmail.com. SaberMartialArtsFoundation@gmail.com. Hit us up about anything. Oh, I heard you were talking about rhythmic gymnastics versus regular gymnastics. I want to put you straight on that. Please do. Oh, you guys suck at Makashi. Let me tell you how it really... Please do. By the way, I loved your Seresu talk. Awesome. Please tell me more. By the way, you're super wrong about boxing gloves. Let me know. This is all great. But also, I want to give a little shout out to the community we're building here. Last week, I said, obviously, United States has our highest listenership. But I'm looking right now at our analytics. And last week, I gave a little shout out to New Zealand because they're our second place. But right behind New Zealand in listenership for Smavcast, a hotbed of swordsmanship in history. Germany, third place listenership for Smavcast. Very honored. Last week we talked about New Zealand's strong warrior culture. Germany's just got just as strong of a warrior culture, all different kinds of warrior cultures throughout the history. And we are honored to have you guys as listeners. So if you are one of our American, even New Zealand, German listeners, or anywhere else. So I think over the next few weeks here, we're going to give a few shout outs to some of these other locations in the world where this community is enjoying the content, enjoying each other, and enjoying, you know, sort of this, like you said, this infantile martial art that we're trying to build up into a tradition, a new tradition.
Absolutely.
Instagram, by the way, Instagram at SMA Foundation. Go check it out. We've been active lately. Share it with your friends. And anytime a new podcast drops, hopefully I will have at least a screenshot up so that you guys can keep up with that. But some of that holocron, some of this stuff we've talked about tonight, some of this, like this training, this tradition, this evolution, you can see it all right there in pictorial form on our Instagram, and you will over the future as well. Alan, sorry, go ahead, right into what you were saying.
Oh, no worries. I wanted to announce that I'll be doing a European tour in 2025.
Ooh. So
if you have a lightsaber and you are in the British Isles, in France, Germany, somewhere there, if I can, I'll try to make it to you. I'll try to...
You hear that, German listeners? You hear that?
Yeah.
Well, Danke Shane, and I don't know how to say bring your own saber in German, but if I did, that's what I'd say.
I don't know what just happened. I was like, what? Okay. Well, on that note, this party's over? Bring your own saber.